This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Would you look over the table? It looks as though it's Dr. Mark Kermode back for some more entertaining conversations about movies.
Can we start by saying, because I think it's important, because I know there's been a lot of stuff, people, I haven't seen Avatar yet. I'm seeing Avatar tonight. Now, I believe that you are officially under embargo, aren't you?
Well...
No, yes, you are. I don't want to break that if you are, but...
Well, I am. Yes, I am. But yesterday, you know...
You were talking about the film with James Cameron.
So, to the extent that... I've talked about it with the director of the film who's been on the programme.
It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, it doesn't really. And we've had, you know, all kinds of reviews in the newspapers today, and there was...
I haven't seen the papers. Has there been reviews in the papers today?
Yeah.
And what's the general feeling?
Well, I don't think it's up to me to...
tell me what's written in the newspapers, because that's your job.
There are no opinions that are valid, of course.
No, other than that's fine.
Individual opinions and your opinion.
Well, I'm going tonight, and I am going... I mean, I know people. Nobody believes this, but I am going in with an open mind. I mean, you know, as always, I am going in with my eyes wide open and my brain equally wide open.
I sat there thinking... I've got no idea what I can say about this and what I can't say about this. But I sat there thinking, I think what Mark's going to be thinking at this point.
Okay.
And I know what I'm thinking.
Okay. And were they the same or divergent?
I think they were divergent, yeah. But I'm not sure.
Was the Bill Murray cameo everything you expected it to be?
It was great.
They're great. And the bit with the dancing chickens, that was good as well?
No, that was disappointing.
Okay, right. And the roller skating and the bit with Linda Blair in it, that was good as well.
The one thing you can say is that it's 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Is that what it is?
Something like that.
Yeah, no, I was under the impression that we were pushing toward the 3 hour mark.
No.
As you know, James has never liked to do anything small. It's really funny because I was reading an article that I had written years and years ago when Aliens...
You were reading one of your own articles?
No, for research. I don't read my own articles for the fun of it. But I was reading the article...
me and the rest go,
thank you, I'm here all week, don't forget to tip your waitress and try the veal. About the Aliens special edition. Because back in the 80s, the idea of doing a special edition of something seemed to be terribly sort of new and funky and exciting. And James Cameron said in this piece, he said, you know, the way you've got to look at movies now is it's like... it's like the 7-inch single, the 12-inch remix, the album version. You know, this is what that. And we all thought, wow, what an incredibly forward-thinking, extraordinarily futuristic way of looking at the world. Because now, 7-inch single, 12-inch single, album, all sounds like total nonsense. But back then, he was adding stuff to movies, and I was saying it's so great. The way that things have changed means that directors can now have all the time they want to make movies. And now, of course, I'm the guy who says anything over 89 minutes, and you're really not trying. But I'm looking forward to it.
Here come some thoughts from Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, really?
It's an interview with Colin Paterson, which went out on Breakfast this morning, on Drive yesterday. I do beg your pardon, it was out on Drive yesterday.
Yeah.
It's about Avatar. She's in Avatar. It's about 3D. It's about you. Here's Sigourney Weaver.
Our movie critic, Mark Kermode, is not a fan of 3D. Give him the hard sell.
Yes, listen, Mark, you're in for a treat. If we ever meet, I'd like to hear what you think of this, because I don't really like 3D either, and I thought this was pretty awesome.
There you go.
Well, no, but you know what's really heartbreaking about that?
She's not here to say that?
No, we have met. But, I mean, of course, you know, clearly I didn't make any... I did a big documentary...
It's funny that she doesn't remember that.
No, I'll tell you why it's funny, because I did a big documentary about Alien in which we did... I did a very, you know, fairly long interview with her. And afterwards she said, oh, that's great, you know, it's really good. And because you realise that, of course, you are just, you know, the umpteenth schlub who's come in and said, so, Sigourney, please tell me about the feminist undercurrent of the Alien movies and the entire cycle as a metaphor for birth.
Yeah, well, that would have been memorable if you'd asked it like that.
I did ask it like that, and she said, it's very interesting that you should bring that up. And then we talked about the role of Newt in the extended edition.
OK, so coming up between now and 4 o'clock, we'll do Box Office Top 10 in just a moment. Yep. Do as many of your emails as we possibly can. Also, Dermot O'Leary is going to be joining us the other side of 3:30. Just wants to tell us about the X Factor final. Do you know about X Factor? It's that show on ITV with singers.
Nope, go on. Fill me in.
No, it's fine. So let's do a Box Office Top 10. First of all, A Serious Man is at number 10. No Move.
Coen Brothers movie, one that I thought was a strange, quirky widget of a film. You've seen it as well. And you have seen it, haven't you? I'm not making that up. You have. And I like it very much. The thing I like almost most about it is just how much everybody else seems to like it as well. Because every now and then something happens when somebody makes a quirky individual... Quirky, I hate that word. A distinctive individual film that you think that's fine. It's going to be liked by three men and a dog. And in fact, then everybody likes it. And you think, wow, well, in fact, that's demonstration that, you know, cinema audiences are dead smart and there's no excuse for giving them Transformers 2 all the time.
The Decent Part 2, is it?
Yeah, it's not that decent. That's the problem. I mean, the first Decent was very, very decent indeed and really did scare me. And but this is just... Somebody put something on Twitter about the Descent Griblies, saying this actually is a title of it in some territories, which I...
The Descent Griblies.
Griblies, yeah. I mean, I would pay to see The Descent Griblies. It's like Critters. But no, The Descent Part 2, it's just... It's not even more of the same. It's the same, but done rather, you know, with rather less panache and certainly less scares.
The Box...
You know, Richard Kelly's a funny old case. I really like Donnie Darko, although that's a classic case of the original cut is better than the director's cut. And as far as I understand with the director's cut, Donnie Darko, it was put together in order to be able to re-release the movie in America. And then he went off and did some really poor stuff. I mean, Southland Tales was really mind-bendingly bad. I thought it was a career ender. And now he's come back with this, which is an extended Twilight Zone episode. And it's too long and it's baggy and it falls apart in the final third. But there is some good stuff in there. It has the problem of attempting to over-explain itself, and in a way, the real key to all those little stories is the sort of sci-fi morality tales is their simplicity, and this isn't simple, but it does have some charm.
Nativity at 7.
Yeah, and why are you saying it like that?
Because it's got an exclamation mark.
Do you say exclamation mark or point?
Exclamation mark. No one says exclamation point.
Yeah, they do.
No, they don't.
Yeah, the Americans.
Well, are we broadcasting to... Well, we are, but... Well,
yeah, you know. But yeah, we get, you know, letters from people on the other side of the world. So, yes, there's a guy in Sydney.
Yes, but we talk about pavements, don't we? We're broadcasting to the United Kingdom.
When you
therefore,
went to school...
it's an exclamation mark.
When you went to school, did you do math... or maths.
Maths.
Yeah, you see, that's the worst, isn't it? The Americans do maths. That's why they do so much better, because they're only doing the math. We do maths, anyway. Which is more and more complicated. I thought Nativity was fine. There was a collective decision by British critics to overlook the fact that it was a U certificate kids movie, and I thought it was funnier than people gave it credit for. I read some totally stinky reviews, and it's, you know, some of the kids stuff in it is cute.
We'll zip through these. We're going to try and do the 10 before 3.
Fine.
Okay, 2012 at 6.
Well, what else is there to say?
Apparently, again, from our tweet followers,
yes.
They love it in China because, of course, China is very important in the climax of the film. And so 2012 is absolutely huge and they love it.
But the place that's really important in the end of the climax of the film is Africa.
Law-abiding citizen is at number 5.
Don't move on like that was an irrelevant point.
It is an irrelevant. I'm trying to get everything in.
Okay, law-abiding citizen. I mean, I wonder about the meetings in which Jamie Foxx found out that he was playing second fiddle to Gerard Butler! And it is meat-headed in the extreme. The problem with it is that I could quite enjoy a good meat-headed revenge movie. I quite like all the bits in the trailer. The problem is that when the bits in the trailer are interrupted by the stodgy bit in the film in which they have to get from the bit when he says that thing to the bit when he says that thing to the bit when he blows that bit up to the bit when he hits that guy, it's kind of boring. And I realised that I had seen all the good bits in the trailer. So my advice is... because the trailer is good, go and see another film, but ask the cinema manager which films you can see that have got the trailer for Law Abiding Citizen first, and then you get the best of both worlds.
We have Planet 51 at number 4.
Which I kind of quite liked. It had this sort of retro design to it, do you remember that film Robots? Remember the animated feature Robots?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which, again, it wasn't received very well, but I rather liked it because it had a kind of 50s pastel shade aesthetic to it. The thing with Planet 51 is it is like a movie made by people who are... I mean, obviously, it has a connection with Shrek anyway, but it's also made by people who do have a love of those 1950s science fiction movies in the same way, I suppose, that Monsters vs. Aliens did. And just on an aesthetic level, I thought it was rather nicely done. It's nothing extraordinary, certainly nothing to write home about, but I was... totally, you know, not bored, enjoyed myself watching it, thought those designs look really nice, and some of the gags are quite funny.
Twilight Saga New Moon at number 3.
Standing Mike up for it, and I'm fed up of people telling me how wrong I am.
Mike in Dublin. Can the good doctor explain his assertion with an eye on the clock here in last week's film reviews that Twilight is somehow not about abstinence, whilst also stating in the same show that all vampire films are about sex
abstinence.
And abstinence?
Yes. Well, they are all about that, but they are also about more than that. The problem with it is it's the reductio ad absurdum thing. It's the taking a single thing and saying this is all it is about. They are about, I mean, in the same way that, and classic example, The Exorcist is about paedophobia, but it is not just about paedophobia.
Thank you. This from Louise, Big Ronnie, Little Ronnie. I know you're big fans of Twilight. I honestly do feel uncomfortable with the phenomenon. I'm 19. This is possibly a little too old to get sucked into its universe.
I'm 47.
Give me Harry Potter any day. What with all the intelligent and brave Hermione, the brilliantly trippy Luna Lovegood, their female characters, who even if they weren't friends with Harry, would be functioning human beings and not being a drippy mare waiting for their geriatric boyfriend to rescue them.
It's funny, isn't it, that there's nobody who can slag off that teenage girl better than other teenage girls.
I think
she's fine, that woman. I think Bella's fine. I think you're all giving her a very short shrift. What is a shrift?
Jordan suggesting that we combine Bella and Edward, because that's what they're doing with Jedwood and all that, and call them Bellwood. So for Twiglet now stars Bellwood, and that saved a lot of time.
You've got 10 seconds to do this.
Disney's A Christmas Carol at 2.
Preferred the book and the Muppet Christmas Carol.
Paranormal Activity, the UK's number one film.
Didn't scare me, but I understand that it is scaring many other people, including the 12-year-old James King, who couldn't sleep for 3 nights.
What a wuss. So some correspondence to clear up. What are we going to do first of all?
Where the Wild Things Are.
Right. First of all, on the emails, Carol Crawford in Sydney.
Yeah.
On the subject of Avatar.
Yes. Has she seen it?
Avatar, The Legend of Aang, The Last Airbender.
Oh, The Airbender, fine. Right,
okay. It's an interesting animated series, she says. The term Avatar, coming from the Sanskrit word avatara, which means descent. Its roots are, bear with me on this, ava meaning down, try to pass. In the Hindu scriptures, it signifies the descent of divinity into flesh. One who attains union with spirit and then returns to earth to help humanity is called an avatar. I bought the series DVD. This is The Last Airbender.
Yes. Because that was originally called Avatar, The Legend of
Aang.
Yeah, fine.
I bought the series DVD for my nephew and enjoyed watching it myself. One of the characters, Commander Zhao, is voiced by Jason Isaacs.
Is it? Oh, fantastic.
Everything
comes back to
Jason.
It's all that. It was 3 degrees of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but it is 3 degrees of Jason Isaacs.
So, hello, Jason.
Hello, Jason.
By the way, on the subject of Avatar, the movie, most of the people going with the description, because we like these anyway, Dances with Wolves in Space, Works, and Smurfahontas came from one of our tweeters. It's the Smurfs and Pocahontas. And that's kind of all you need to know. Okay. And when you see it, I've now spoiled it with you. So, Dear Donna and Blitzen, this is Steve Gilbride. Saw Paranormal Inactivity last night, actually one of the most boring and repetitive films I've ever seen. Anyway, a few household appliance film titles. I can't remember why this started last week, but
it was a cleaning thing. Well, no, it's because you said an airbender sounded like a vacuum cleaner.
So then we got midweek, and I meant to write this down, so apologies for the tweeter who sent in Henry, Portrait of a Vacuum Cleaner, which I did quite like.
That's good.
But Steve sends in The Last Pear Blender, Henry, Vacuum of a Cereal Spiller, and various others. So
Henry's signing up quite a lot.
And also, Tim Wilson in New York City saying that The Last Airbender is the beginning of a franchise. He understands. Mm. So maybe listeners could come up with subsequent titles.
Yeah, well, they're going to work themselves back towards the first Airbender, yes.
Yeah. So if there are any subsequent movies that would suggest you as being appropriate to follow on from the huge hit, which will be
The Last Airbender,
starring Dev Patel.
Although I'm called, oh no, sorry, there's one more behind him. Oh, blimey, look, there's a whole load we hadn't seen before.
Eamon in Southampton. Hello, He-Man and She-Ra. Can you guys go easy on The Last Airbender? Mm. Originally Avatar, but Cameron bought movies. It bought the movie rights to the name first. It's actually a beautifully told animation series from Nickelodeon. It deserves a little more respect.
No, so we're not being disrespectful about the animated series, which features the voice of Jason Isaacs. I'm sure it's marvellous. We're being disrespectful about the M. Night Shyamalan-a-lama-lama-ding-dong movie called The Last Airbender. Sorry.
Where do you go with after The Last Airbender? Titles welcome. Let's do a big new kind of family movie for the holiday season.
That's interesting. Why did you say kind of?
Because, just reading some of the correspondence on it, there are a number of people, for example, well, we'll start with it if you want. Justin Landskron from Hendon.
Yes.
Dear Levy and Redknapp, obviously a reference to Daniel football. Levy and Jimmy Harry Redknapp.
Isn't there a Jimmy Redknapp?
Yeah, there's a Jamie Redknapp. Very good.
Oh, fine, there we go.
Okay. Most impressed. I'm a long-term listener, blah, 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 blah. My latest...
okay.
Love the show, Steve.
Yeah, great.
My latest cinema dilemma centres on the film adaptation of Morris Sendak's classic Where the World Things Are. A few months ago, I took my two sons, Jake, who's 6, and Max, 4, to the cinema. During the trailers, they showed the trailer for Where the World Things Are. And to be honest, my sons were a little scared. Oh. I was a little surprised by the whole look and feel of the film, which seemed disconnected from the original source material, which is much more playful and clearly aimed at children. The trailer definitely gave the impression that this was a fairly dark film. The shaky camera work reminded me of the Bourne movies and seemed inappropriate for a kid's film. Obviously, this will depend from child to child. He wants your advice, basically, as to whether his four-year-old is going to be... He's desperate to see it, but he's worried that he's going to be scared.
There has been much stuff about this. Spike Jones has famously said, "I didn't set out to make a children's movie. I set out to make a film about childhood." It's obviously based on the Morris Sendak novel, illustrated graphic children, which is a fairly slim volume, although you spend, minutes looking at it every page, obviously. The illustrations are so beautiful. And he has served as executive producer. Dave Eggers has co-written the script. So he has been on board with it. And funnily enough, in the press notes, so you shouldn't take everything there completely seriously, there is a little quote from Morris Sendak in which he said to them, apparently said to the filmmakers, don't just take the dark side of him seriously, take the playful side seriously as well, because actually that the key to it is his joy and the joy of his imagination. So in the original book, as you'll know, which is low on plot, obviously, although, very big on imagination, is an unruly kid who's, sent to his room, having been unruly, and he escapes into this fantasy world in which he goes to where the wild things are and becomes kind of, king of the wild things, and then, ends up coming back to his bedroom, and it's all happened in his mind. In the film, what happens is that he literally runs away and then goes on a boat and crosses the ocean to get to where the wild things are. Although one of the things that the film is doing very clearly is that thing that Gilliam has always done, which is to treat fantasy and reality as essentially the same. The basis being that when you're looking through a child's eyes, fantasy and reality look the same. They are, they are all but indistinguishable. So kid runs away, goes to the island of where the wild things are and meets the wild things, voiced by several, grown-up actors, including James Gandolfini. Here's a clip.
You were their king, and you made everything right.
Yeah.
Well, what about loneliness?
What he's saying is, will you keep out all the sadness?
I have a sadness shield that keeps out all the sadness. And it's big enough for all of us.
Wow.
And I do this to loneliness.
Oh, I knew it. When he showed up, I saw it. Why don't you guys ever listen to me?
No, you're right, Carol. I didn't see it.
I don't understand. He doesn't look like a king. If he could be king, I could be king.
Were you the king where you came from?
Yeah, for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
That's impressive.
That's incredible, right?
Oh, wow. Looks like we found our king. You are a king, right?
I am.
Oh, I'm so relieved.
Sorry we were going to eat you. We didn't know you were king.
So it kind of ends on a goofy gag, but as you can hear from the tone of a lot of that, there's a kind of, odd, offbeat, melancholic thing happening. Now, here was the thing. I went in to see where the wild things are with a couple of problems. The first one being that I had taken Fantastic Mr. Fox to task for the fact that what they'd essentially done was taken a kid's story and then made it into a grown-up movie that sort of had the outside appearance of being a kid's story. It wasn't. It was all George Clooney, gabbling about existentialism in a way which was probably kooky and endearing to the sort of New York academic intellectuals, around the spag bowl and a glass of red wine. Ah, ha, 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 we made a kid's movie, but actually we didn't do that at all.
Yeah, focus.
Yeah. No, I am focusing because I had considered that that was probably going to be the problem with taking Where the Wild Things Are, which is clearly a kid's story. But is like
a young kid's story.
Yeah, but like all young kid stories, therefore has within it, a truth and a darkness that we all recognise even as young kids. In fact, those familiar with the book, and I imagine pretty much everyone is familiar with the book, you will know there are elements of the book that are quite disturbing. I mean, the sight of the kid baring his teeth and the idea when he goes off to Where the Wild Things Are, it's not just cosy and comfortable. It is, edgy. And actually, that's one of the reasons why kids like it so much, in the same way that that's why kids are drawn to Snow White, that's why kids are drawn to all great fairy tales. I think that the triumph of Where the Wild Things Are is that he has made a film about childhood, which Although it will clearly work for adults because there is an awful lot of stuff in it that looks like, you know, oh, this is an adult version of what childhood looks like, will also work for children. And I think the reason that will also work for children is twofold. Firstly, it's that almost everything that's in the film is drawn from a legitimate source within the short story. I mean, for example, there's a lot more stuff about the idea that, you know, that, I mean, Max... The young boy, when we first meet him, he's kind of dysfunctional in a way which is, you know, he's very, very sort of disturbed. He can't really communicate. He's one of those kids, he's very, very intelligent, but he can't communicate his feelings, and therefore he kind of comes out as rage. Well, all that, to some extent, is really there in the source. We get much more about his family. His mother seems to be a single mother. The Mark Ruffalo character seems to be the boyfriend. You're not entirely sure. But it's kind of legitimate filling in of the background. It's kind of creating a world from which he runs away. But obviously, when he runs away, he takes all those elements of the world and of his own personality with him. And then when he gets to where the wild things are, the wild things represent these certain sides of his personality that have caused him to sort of, you know, to burst out in uncontrollable anger. First point. So I think everything is legitimately traceable back to the source. Secondly, the creatures are done brilliantly. I mean, they are, I mean, some people have said banana splits, Muppets, you know, it's people in big suits, but with, I think they must be CG animated faces. They made quite a lot of play about the fact that in order to do the voices for them, what they did was they got all the voice cast together and got them to act the thing out on a sound stage. So you're not just getting people doing that thing that Tom Hanks always describes of standing in a sound booth and saying each line 25 times and therefore allowing the editor to choose, you know, I am here, here I, you know, all that. And they're actually doing it as a proper performance. And it is true that when you see the great big gigantic wild things, you know, walking around, which you know, you could kindly say huge banana splits, they are really believable characters because they're talking like believable characters, because their faces are animated properly, but they have a physicality. So you get the real Terry Gilliam physicality, but you also get the computer graphics making the characters look real, making them not just look like puppets. I also think that at the centre of all of this is the sense of wildness. And unless you get that sense of wildness, the story of where the wild things are doesn't make sense. And the mudclod fights in the film are really wild. The wild things throwing each other around and knocking down trees and banging into each other and playing war games and having bundles are really wild. I mean, you really do feel that people might get genuinely hurt. Of course, they are wild things, therefore they probably won't get hurt. But the film begins with the character of Max getting genuinely hurt because the big kids don't understand that he's not as big as they are. And there's a sense of genuine endangerment in the wild antics of the wild things that does give you the sense of real physical interaction, people really throwing great big clods of mud at each other, people really banging each other over the head with great big tree trunks, you know, genuine physical force. And I think those things will make perfect sense to children. I think that the sense of wild imagination being pent up, being unable to be communicated in the real world, and then bursting out in this fantasy world in which all the anxieties, all the uncertainties, all the paranoias, all the fears, all the worries of the real world are matched in the interaction in the fantasy world is actually carried off very well, and carried off, I think, in a way which kids will appreciate. I mean, some people have said it's a grown-up movie, and they've referred back to Spike Jonze thing, I'm not making a children's movie, I'm making a movie about childhood. But if you do that properly, then it is a children's movie, because children are really smart, and children, you know, are much more open to the dark strangenesses of the world than many grown-ups. I mean, actually, you know, we all say, oh, well, you know, kids, they're innocent. No, kids are in the middle of childhood. They understand all those things. Kids are the people who actually believe in monsters under the bed. You talk to Guillermo del Toro, talking to you about all the inspiration for all his monster movies comes from the fact that when he was a kid, he believed that there was a monster living in a cupboard, and he believed there was a monster living under his bed, and he actually ended up making a psychological deal with the monsters. And that was the sort of the source of his creativity. Well, I got the same feeling from Where the Wild Things Are. There were occasional moments, and they were generally around the backstory that I was talking about before, about this mildly dysfunctional family background, that I thought, okay, you're getting very close here to tripping over into the territory that I didn't like about Fantastic Mr. Fox, which was a film that seemed to me to have no eye on the children other than going, oh, well, it's foxes, it's talking foxes and, you know, standing up animals, therefore the kids will swing in with it. But I really was won over by it, and I really do think, and in fact I have some evidence for this, because I know a couple of kids who've seen it, not my kids incidentally, who really, really loved it. I think that it will work, and I think it will endure as a proper kids' movie, despite the fact that an awful lot of adults will look at it and go, hang on a minute, that's not a kids' film. It's a PG certificate, I think, and there are certainly elements...
And that's the starting point, and I was talking about with Rachel about this earlier.
Mm.
How can you make... how can you take this book aimed clearly at young children and make a movie which is a PG?
Do you not think that the book itself is PG?
No, not really.
No, I do, you see. I think that the book itself has PG elements in it. I mean, and I do.
Well,
I mean,
so does Snow White, then.
Oh, well, Snow White has 15 to 18 elements in it. I mean, there are versions... I mean, I tell you what, if you don't believe that, you should see the David Lynch-directed video for Rammstein, which is Snow White done as a... You were just going to say that.
We're going to have a family gathering.
That demonstrates that there, within the Snow White story...
Everyone round to our place.
Yes, is... Well, you know, enjoy... No, but I think the book itself has PG elements, and I think that, that those PG elements are quite legitimately expanded upon in Where the Wild Things Are. I think to have made a U certificate film of it would have been to do the book an injustice.
But if you're six and four, to start with our original listener's point.
I think six, fine. I think four, I mean, you see, again, I grew up with Singing Ringing Tree and you know, and the Magic Roundabout.
Scary which, stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I still think, I know that we have, a jokey, but well, it's not jokey, you really do hate it and you're really wrong, but this thing about the Magic Roundabout movie, Dougal and the Blue Cat, there are things in Dougal and the Blue Cat that you'd be astonished
okay, well,
about
that,
now being,
well,
being
well,
in a kid's
not get
movie.
On about
no,
that.
No, but I think that
but
element...
How about
of,
Toy Story, right? We mentioned this again earlier. Toy Story was a PG. It is a PG.
Yeah, and it's quite right that it is, because the scene in which they go to the kid's house next door and he's got the twisted dolls of it is PG certificate stuff, but is that classic kids' fare? Of course it is. Of course it is. I think you couldn't have made Where the Wild Things Are as a totally anodyne experience, because I think even in the book, you look at the pictures in the book, there are very creepy elements in them, in a good way.
Andy in Liverpool, dear Hot Air and Air Wafter, does old Big Hands think Where the Wild Things Are...
This Big Hands thing's sticking, isn't it?
...is a great advert for old-fashioned special effects over horrible CGI.
Yes, except that clearly CG has been used on the facial expressions, okay. But yes, the key to it is big guys dressed as banana splits.
Lawrence says, let your kids read the book first,
yes,
then they won't be so scared. JWAD.
Well, that confirms what I just said. The elements of it all are in the... You were agreeing with me. It's just that... Yeah, it was just such a rarity that wasn't...
JWAD in Chicago. Dear Max and Carol, I watched Where the Wild Things Are last month and thought it was spectacularly rich, gorgeous to look at, incredibly smart, layered in its themes and evoking good and bad feelings of childhood, unlike any other movie I've seen in ages. Just thoroughly captivating and beautiful all the way through. I took my little sister to see it. She loved it too, just like Caroline and Fantastic Mr. Fox. It has been a great year for children's movies that don't condescend to adults.
It doesn't. I disagree about Mr. Fox, but I agree that it doesn't condescend. I'm going to see if I can print out
Stevie
the BBC
says,
report and send it before the end of the program.
Is Mark reviewing Fraggle Rock, the movie? And this from Collie. Collie, brackets, a bloke, just in case Simon calls me a girl on air again. Mind you, I've been called a lot worse. Dear Max and Carol, surely it's not me. I saw WTWTA. Let's point out, that has 9 syllables in it.
Yeah, and
where the wild things are is 5.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not really much of an abbreviation. Maybe it is if you're typing it, but not if you're going to say it. I don't know why I bother.
It's like his name's John. John O for short.
Saw it while on holiday in the US. Loved every minute of it. Thought it was a magical take on the trauma and joys of childhood, and even had a rather commodian welling up on more than one occasion. What a thought. I even forgot that Carol sounded rather like New Jersey's most famous refuse control operator. However, I imagine that Wall-E? Is that a reference to Wall-E? Would that work?
No, it must be a television thing. Refuge? No.
However, this week, here in Ireland, it has been met with...
Oh, see, I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. There we go, fine.
Oh, Sopranos.
Yes, because it is James Gandolfini. I'm sorry, I just didn't get where we were going with refuse control.
Television.
Yeah, I know, and I have actually seen some episodes of The Sopranos, clearly not that many.
This week, here in Ireland, it has been met with almost universally bad reviews.
Really?
Say It Ain't So, or should Spike and I be thoroughly ashamed of ourselves?
No, has it been met with universally
bad reviews? In Ireland, it has.
Oh, okay. Apparently there was a really stinky review in America with somebody charging Spike Jonze with infantilization. But you go, it's a kid story.
Right, well, look, it's 3:20. How come we're late already? We've only done one movie, and we're late for the
trap. Because we got into a dialogue, and then it carried on.
That's what it was. And Nick actually contributed to the elongation of that review.
Yeah,
so
it's your fault.
So you've got
with
half
my three
the time,
syllables.
Half the time.
Sopranos.
Have you said it more than once?
That's six syllables.
By the way, the best suggestion to follow on from The Last Airbender, is if that's the beginning of the franchise, from Stephen in Wivelsfield Green, the first of the air straighteners. Now, that might work, mightn't it? if you visit the Five Live website, which, as you know, is bbc.co.uk/5live, you will find Mark's 12 Rants of Christmas. That would be fun. Featuring his most animated
reviews.
I'm trying
to sound excited.
His most animated, handy-wafty reviews of the past year. There are five up there already. So it's a bit like getting an advent calendar and going mad. Open five straight away. And then there'll be a new one added between now and our last show of the year, which is next Friday. One more rant will be added. This sounds as though we should have done this 5 days ago. But anyway, here it is. It's there. There are five rants to go at
very good.
Already.
I'll just very quickly give you this from the BBFC. God bless them and happy Christmas to them. Wild Things are PG for mild threat and brief violence. Interestingly enough, they say there is some mild violence in the fantasy section, but it is fantasy. Then what they say is they say that there's the section where Max loses his temper and bites his mother on the shoulder. There's no focus on any damage, but there is an emotional intensity to the sequence, with Max being uncontrollably upset, that might be unsettling for very young viewers. Interesting that they focused in on the stuff in the real world, not in the fantasy world. It says elsewhere, mild threat, with the creature saying several times they're going to eat Max, and at one point he discovers a pile of bones that he suspects belongs to previous kings. However, the threats are not carried out, and Max is never really scared of the creatures because they're creatures of his own imagination. Again, hats off to the BBFC for identifying the stuff in the real world as where the real emotional trauma would lie, and congratulations on the correct verdict for it, PG.
Thomas Blick says, Dear Holmes and Watson, when does the Good Doctor review the new Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes film? I believe it's released on Christmas Day, which, even though it's a Friday, I don't believe either of you will be broadcasting to the nation. Shame
next
on
Friday.
You. I would say there is a programme that we're doing on Christmas. That doesn't involve you. It's the best of 8.5 years of this programme.
Thank you. And it doesn't involve me.
But you're not in it. So, and then Thomas shockingly says, I'll admit that despite everything that's gone before, I'm actually looking forward to this.
Yeah, shall I give you a heads up? I'm actually looking forward to it. I suspect that if Guy Ritchie was ever going to make a good film, this might be it. I don't know. I've got no reason. But, you know, hey, go into everything with an open mind. I'd quite like to like a Guy Ritchie film. So I think I'm seeing it on Monday. So we'll review it next Friday.
Matt in Brighton, The Wild Things faces were built and puppeteered on set, some by my friend Tom, says Matt.
Well,
there was a little CGI cleaning up, and also the long shots and some of the jumping and stuff were CGI, but it is mostly live action robotics.
Well, in that case, Matt. That's very impressive.
Matt's friend Tom did them.
No, well, thank you for that. I was reading through in the production notes about them talking about the way in which they've got an underwired CG thing working over the top of even the static images you could already see. Blah. We looked at the film, tried to animate the faces without completing. Here we go. We looked at the film. It was so beautiful. We tried to animate the faces without creating a completely CG version of them. Instead, we did only the movement of the face in CGI. So it's clearly a combination, but thank you for pointing that out. I mean, puppetry, God bless it, is as much the future as CG ever would have been.
We're going to go to the news on time, and then after that we're going to be speaking to Dermot O'Leary about the X Factor Final. We'll continue with the Wittertainment. So what can you fit in 2 minutes, Doctor?
Oh, heaven's sake. OK, well, should we do very, very quickly the new movie by Jim Jarmusch, because we're not going to play a threat of this, which is called The Limits of Control. Jim Jarmusch, I have been a fan of in the past because he's done some great independent stuff. At some point, he was basically the king of independent cinema. He is now, I think, in danger of becoming the king of just kooky cool. The story here is you have a very, very enigmatic hitman who goes to a very enigmatic boss who says to him, the universe has no centre and no edges. Go and meet all these people. They'll each give you a matchbox and then you'll go on to the next person. And then he does. And he has a series of encounters with basically famous people like Tilda Swinton, and finally ends up with Bill Murray and Gael Garcia Bernal and John Hurt. And in each encounter, the first thing the person says to him is, you don't speak Spanish, do you? And he says, no. And then they give him some life philosophy, and then they give him a matchbox or something else, and then he goes off on. And it's one of those really with. I mean, obviously, it owes a lot to Ghost Dog Way of the Samurai, and obviously, it nods also towards Melville's The Samurai and Point Blank. And there are times in it when I'm going, God, this just looks beautiful. It's shot by Christopher Doyle. It's got an interesting score that I thought was by Neil Young, but wasn't. And, you know, it's kooky in a good sort of, intellectual, cool surface kind of way. And at other points, you're thinking, no, it's actually just a collection of bits with famous people coming on, working for one day, saying some kooky stuff and then leaving with a matchbox. And I think the problem with it is, if you're a real diehard Jim Jarmusch fan, you might find it mildly diverting. If you're somebody who finds that indie cinema can become too navel-gazing for its own good, you will quite quickly become, as I did, sort of slightly irritated by the film, and I spent the whole film in that awkward sense of there are things about this I like, there are lovely little moments in it, but then there's a moment in which a naked woman is on screen for a very long time for no really good purpose, and I was thinking, if this was in a trashy slasher movie, would I forgive it, or is it just because it's art that it's okay, she's naked but sleeping with her spectacles on, but that's okay because it's ironic? And you think, well,
why is sleeping with your spectacles on if you're naked ironic?
Because nobody sleeps with their spectacles on.
Do you know that? Is that right?
Right, OK. I challenge listeners. Somebody who sleeps naked with their spectacles on in a non-ironic way, please let me know.
But if you do, it's ironic. You would do it as ironic rather than forgetful. What if you're naked and you're just forgetful?
She hasn't fallen asleep forgetfully. She has fallen asleep with her glasses on, without her clothes on, ironically.
All right.
Yes. So it's eyebrow raised. And so, as I said, things about it that look really nice. I still think that Jim Jarmusch, who's got a better quiff than I have and has made better films than, you know, most people, it's a little whimsy as opposed to anything else.
Matt in Portsmouth, dear Big Hands and the Hendersons, surely the naked woman may have been reading before she slept, so it's not really ironic at all. So
no,
she was naked,
no,
reading, she fell asleep,
no,
she's still got glasses,
no,
on.
No, because she doesn't have in her hand glasses. She is poised in a statuesque manner against the fully clothed body of the hitman, who significantly is not interested in her, despite the fact that she's naked and wearing a pair of glasses, ironically.
Danny in Warwickshire, my wife often wakes with the alarm in the morning, puts glasses on, then falls back to sleep. I doubt her employers would find ensuing lateness ironic. So maybe
that's what happens.
Maybe that's
actually
what
that's
was.
Probably the best the best answer.
John Clare saying, "Dear you and me, perhaps all the cinema ticket sellers who are fed up with people asking to see Saw, can get their own back now. When someone asks for, can I have a ticket for me and Orson Welles? So you say, well, is that two tickets? And he says, love the show, Steve.
Can I read you this very quickly from the, just to clear up the animatronic computer thing? This is from the official notes where the Wild Things, it's one paragraph. No, because it's important.
Brief.
The final touch was enabling the Wild Things features to match their emotions. Rather than using animatronic models, which would have caused lip sync problems due to the creature's enormous mouths, Jones opted to enhance their expressions in post-production with computer animation led by, which means, as I was trying to say before, but again, thank you very much for writing in and clarifying this, that it is what happening with them is it's essentially puppetry based with but using CGI.
I think we've got that.
You know, but I think it's important to get that right and credit where
Stepfather,
it's due.
Then.
You had enough of that, have you?
Okay, well, I just think, you know, there's only so many nuances you can put between puppeteering and CGI.
Okay, fine. Well, yeah, fine. Stepfather, remake of the 1980s chiller, with which I am sure you are familiar, Simon.
Nope.
Never seen The Stepfather?
Nope.
Okay, so the story in The Stepfather is he's a stepfather, and he seems to be okay, but you know what? He's not. And it was made by Joseph Rubin, who went on to make Sleeping with the Enemy, which was essentially the same movie. Do you remember Sleeping with the Enemy? With Patrick Bergin and Julia Roberts. And Julia Roberts was married to this guy who was, you know, he looked from the outside like he was suave and wonderful, right? Okay, but in fact it turned out he was psycho. And the moment that you found out that he was psycho was the moment when he went into the bathroom and the towels weren't quite correctly, and Patrick Bergin reached out and corrected the towels in a way which said, I am just so mad, if I were you I would run a mile. Okay, so in the original one was quite interesting because it was satirical, like many sort of great shockers. It was a satirical thing. It was about the satirical idea of somebody attempting to form the perfect family home but being a total murderer and mad psycho in the process. Now we have a remake of it in which Terry O'Quinn is replaced by Dylan Walsh, who is the nice on the outside but clearly psycho on the inside. Incidentally, we know I'm not giving anything away, we know this from the opening sequence. He is a lone man who seeks out lone women with families in which he can become the stepfather. The latest prey, he doesn't realise, I think we think he doesn't realise at the beginning, that the woman that he chooses as his latest host for his family actually has an elder son who is coming back from military school who doesn't trust him one jot. Nor do we. But there we go. Here's a clip.
There we go. Now, don't let your mom know I've got a tequila stash. Worked my ass off trying to convince her I'm perfect. I know this must be a bit of a shock, mom and me getting married and all, but I want you to know, I want us to be a real family.
Because without it, we have nothing.
Oh. Okay. Shape. So I get a little corny sometimes. I meant what I said. You just let me handle your mother, and I'm
want to make sure you stay right here, where you belong. No more military school. We're going to put this family back together, you and me, father and son.
Stepfather.
Stepfather. And son.
So the questions are, firstly, why remake a perfectly workable cello, which was, you know, made for not very much money in the 1980s, which spawned a whole bunch of sequels, which did exactly what it was meant to do and did have an interesting satirical edge to it? I mean, why remake it if you're not bringing anything else to the party? That's the first thing. The second thing is that if you're going to redo something that did have a satirical edge, you really ought to have a satirical edge in the remake. Otherwise, it kind of looks like you were sort of missing the point. What you get here, it's like somebody remembering a film but not remembering it very well and remembering all the wrong bits of it. You know, sometimes somebody will go and see a film that you've seen and you've liked and they'll go, yeah, 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 and I really like the bit when they'll tell you all the wrong bits of the film. They won't hit any of the significant points. It's like they've seen Rambo and all they can talk about is the rocket launches and the night. They don't understand any of the other stuff in it. Well, this is kind of like that. The situation is exacerbated by the fact that there is a co-starring role for Amber Heard, who's the girl from All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. And it looks to me like literally she has been cast for the ability to walk around in her pants. There was
ironically?
No, not ironically. And that's the very worst thing. But well done for going straight to the heart of that. Exactly, not ironically. There was
How can you tell
whether it's ironic or not? Here's how you can tell. When Linda was doing that book about erotic thrillers, and she interviewed these people that made...
What was that called again?
It was called The Erotic Thriller in Contemporary Cinema. Thank you for letting me mention it. She was interviewing these people who produced these straight-to-video erotic thrillers, and one of them said, with any of the plot points, what they would do is they go, this is great, but can't they have this conversation in the shower, right? Well, these are straight-to-video sleaze. In the case of this, it looked like the producer of The Stepfather went, this is great, but can't she have this conversation in the pool wearing a bikini? Or, this is great, but can't she have this conversation on the phone, lying on a bed in her pants? And it's to the point that people were laughing in the cinema, not in an ironic way, but laughing as in, this is ridiculous. It was like there was a film of The Stepfather going on. Then they went, where's Amber? Where's Amber? Amber, in your pants, just would you mind just walking around there, having a conversation about the plot? And you kind of thought, didn't we all stop doing this ages and ages ago? The film's got a 15 certificate, and apparently, according to the BBFC, there was some re-editing was done to give it a 15 certificate. Well, I really honestly cannot tell what it was that was done to do it. There are some incredibly clunky plot points. Like, for example, if you were a serial psycho who went from family to family and then disappeared off into the ether, completely untraceable, do you think that if you were in the family household and you looked yourself up on America's Most Wanted on the internet, do you think you'd then clear the window afterwards, the history window, so that the next person that came along couldn't go, it's a funny thing, Dad's been looking himself up on America's Most Wanted?
Yes, I suppose you would use that clear history button.
Yeah, but you know, it's like he's evaded the FBI for the last however long it is. Really, the FBI aren't trying. You know what? Just put out a warning. If there's a guy who's looking himself up on America's Most, you know what? It's probably him. So it was like a memory of a film that we'd all enjoyed in the 1980s, but done bigger and stupider and with more people. I mean, there was actually a gratuitous shower sequence in the first film, but I think that was done ironically. Well, you know, tongue in cheek.
Because she was wearing glasses in the shower.
In the shower.
Now, that would be ironic. Dear Elvis and the Colonel, listen to your podcast as I negotiate the streets of Dubai. I am sure, like most of our gender, says Colin, you are yet to even contemplate Christmas shopping, let alone have decided upon suitable gifts for each other. Simon, I suggest that Dr. Kermode is the lucky recipient of a thick rubber mat, which can be kept in the studio and placed under said doctor's arm during the broadcast.
Oh, sorry, am I back?
It would need to be of sufficient thickness to deaden the sound of his arm or hand or head hitting the studio desk, which, when listening to the podcast at least, leaves me to wonder if a series of invisible birds is hitting my windscreen. I don't want anything to take away from the doctor's passion and expression. I'd just like not to have to replace my speakers anytime soon.
Sorry.
That's what I'm going to get you. Big rubber mat.
Big rubber mat, that's fine.
Okay. It was a hit for Joni Mitchell, wasn't it? Anyway, what can you fit in 3 minutes?
Away my old man. Carriers. Post-apocalyptic movie. Right, you saw The Road, okay?
Yes.
Okay, so Carriers.
Well, apart from the last 15 minutes.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, well, you know what happened. The helicopter came and saved them. It was fun. And then they all went to Africa, which was marvellous. The Road, post-apocalyptic movie in which a father and son are on the road going towards the coast and the whole of humanity is dying around them. Carriers, post-apocalyptic movie in which a virus has broken out and has contaged everybody. And two young men and two young women are on the road heading towards the coast. One of the young men happens to be Chris Pine, who, of course, is Captain Kirk in the new Star Trek movie, which is a real good film, which I liked very much. And recently there was a Chris Pine movie that he'd made before Star Trek called Blind Dating, which was issued in the wake of Star Trek, clearly on the back of Chris Pine, is now a superstar. And I sort of suspected that this might have been one that he'd made before Star Trek, although I looked it up in the IMDb and it appears to be chronologically afterwards. He may have shot it before, but maybe not. See, the weird thing about it is, we've got a clip, but we don't really have time for it. The weird thing about it is, it's not a bad movie. It's just a very depressing downbeat movie that is that stars Chris Pine, who's going to kind of attempt to bring in a teenage audience, and yet it doesn't have the humour and riotous jollity of Zombieland. It doesn't have the Cormac McCarthy, this is for grown-ups, this is a serious movie quality of Road. What it has is a strange sort of, well, you know, we get the teenagers in because it's that guy Chris Pine, but actually what we're then going to give them is a story about a virus killing a load of people, and if anyone breathes a virus on you, you're going to die and be left behind. And the moral of the story is that in extremis, people pretty much forget how to behave like decent human beings, and everything's a bit rubbish. And all the things that I like about it, which are the negativity, the bleakness, the grimness, the refusal to make everything all right in the end, are all the things that I think probably aren't going to appeal to the target audience. They're going, look, there's a new Chris Pine movie in the cinema, let's go and see that. Now, it may be that, in fact, he's very bravely attempting to escape from any possibility that, in the wake of Star Trek, people will go along to see him because they'll see, you know, action-adventure movies with a good-looking bloke running around with his shirt off. You know, fine, maybe that is what he's doing. But it's... At the same time as I was looking at it and going, well, there are things in here that are quite interesting, but it's not edgy enough to be a proper edgy movie. It's a bit too bland for its own good, but there is darkness in there that's kind of fighting against the substance of the film.
Movie of the week?
Where the Wild Things Are, for everyone, young and old, but not very young, probably.
On Monday, Simon Callow, Simon Singh, David Morrissey is going to be here. Hello, David.
Hello, David.
Hello, Fairport.
Hello, Fairport. Hello, Jason.
And hello, Stephen.
Fry.
Yeah,
fellows.
Yeah, that's right. Someone's shouting at me. Oh, and Michael Sheen. We forgot Michael Sheen. That's a terrible thing. And David Tennant.
Michael Sheen. You went all like that. Michael Sheen, forgotten him.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. Have a fantastic weekend. Back on Monday.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.